Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Hey, warm welcome to the show. Bill Arnold here with you today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting Faith Radio. Thank you for being you. So, you know, I remember watching Seinfeld one night and Kramer says to Jerry, "It's all attitude, Jerry." And that kind of made me laugh and, of course, stuck with me because whenever I laugh about something, I usually remember it. But it is really true. I think Chuck Swindoll said life is 10% what happens to you and 90% how you respond to it. So here's the question, Rebecca, I'm going to ask you. Would you consider yourself a person that has enthusiasm?
Sure, if I like what I'm doing. That depends.
Yeah.
What's on the chore list for today?
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Fair enough. My first guest today, Matt Norman, is got quite a story of being afraid of getting up in front of people to now teaching Dale Carnegie classes throughout the Upper Midwest. And he's got a charming story, and had a great chance to chat with him last week. We're going to bring that interview on in just a minute. And then my friend Patrick Albanese, my friend and colleague from prestigious West Des Moines, will be with me in the second part of the hour. So we have a really great show, and awfully glad that you've joined me today to listen. So we'll take a little break, and when we come back, Matt Norman is my guest.
Hi, I'm Dick Whitworth, General Manager for Faith Radio. I wanted this opportunity to say thank you. Thank you for praying for Faith Radio. We're growing. Thank you for giving. For the second year in a row, Faith Radio ended our fiscal year June 30th fully funded. And last but not least, thank you for telling your family and friends about this ministry. As we look forward to the coming months of 2018, please know that we appreciate you and we're grateful for your friendship. God bless you.
It's been said that the only thing that is constant is change. When there are programming changes here at Faith Radio, we want you to know. You can easily stay informed through our ministry updates page at myfaithradio.com. You can also learn about upcoming events and current giveaways and see the latest trending articles. Access Faith Radio ministry updates under the About tab at myfaithradio.com.
Welcome back to the show. I am absolutely thrilled that you are listening because I've got a great guest in studio. And if you are ever thinking, I need to have more enthusiasm in life, you have come to the right place. So listen up, grab a pen. My guest is Matt Norman. He's president and CEO of Norman & Associates, which offers Dale Carnegie programs throughout the Upper Midwest. And he is with me right now in studio. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Bill.
Well, I'm always intrigued by people like you who have a great deal of enthusiasm, because without that, we don't have much in life, do we?
You know, I write a weekly article at mattnorman.com, and this last week I wrote about enthusiasm. I talked about my first job.
I read about
that. Did you see that?
Yes, and you became a lover of Van Halen because of a guy you worked with who never offered any perspective on it other than he just modeled loving it.
He does. KJS could play more Van Halen.
Yeah, I'll do that on my last day at work. Because if I play that, it will be my last day.
I know.
Yeah. Tell me about that experience, because it resonated with me the minute I read it.
I remember looking up to him as my manager, and as soon as the store would close in the Eden Prairie Shopping Center, he would play air guitar and rock out to Van Halen. And he never said anything about the qualities of Van Halen. I just watched his excitement, and it was contagious.
Yeah. Being enthusiastic about something is really critical to having momentum in life, you know, especially in teamwork. Agree?
I do. And I think enthusiasm connects to confidence. Mm-hmm. You know, I think when we see someone who's enthusiastic, we see them as confidence, which is also attractive. And I think that confidence increases our performance in the work that we do.
Yeah. And I think I've heard this expression before. I don't know who it is attributed to, but in order to be enthusiastic, you must act enthusiastic.
It's Dale Carnegie.
Is that okay? There you go. So that stuck with me forever. And that was a long, long time ago. I wasn't sure if that was Dale or not, but that's still with me.
It is.
You know, and I think I heard that when I was 17.
it's a memorable phrase. And in our programs, we often find that when we do things that are out of our comfort zone and do them with energy, that that confidence and enthusiasm translates to other hard things that we're trying to do in our lives.
Yeah. So, Matt, tell me a little bit about your faith journey, too, because I was talking to a friend of mine who said, you have got to meet Matt Norman. Here's his number, call him. So I did, because I always obey him when he tells me to do stuff.
He's a great guy.
Yeah.
So I grew up in a traditional Lutheran family, Scandinavian Lutheran.
I can see it all over
can
your
you
face.
See that? Yeah.
If we had a webcam, there'd be no questioning what he's saying right now.
So I had a great experience in our Lutheran church in Eden Prairie. Was definitely ministered to by our youth pastor.
Nice.
Really looked up to him. And yet I got to a point in my life shortly after college where I suffered from anxiety, and I avoided challenging situations with people, team meetings, presenting in front of groups. And I called my dad, and he suggested I take a Dale Carnegie program. And that was what sort of got me into the Dale Carnegie business. And as I also connected with my pastor at the time, this was when I was living in Boston, and he helped me to realize that I was holding on to control too tightly in my life, and that I needed to let go of that control. And that was a significant defining moment in my faith journey. So my vocation and my faith journey align fairly closely.
Yeah. Now, when you talk about some of your anxiety that you had, that was very real, wasn't it?
It was. I remember having panic attacks, pulling off the side of the freeway, hiding in my office rather than going into conference rooms. I would take walks in the middle of the workday just to regain my composure. And it was just a really dark time. I mean, I really leaned into God at that time. I did a lot of prayer. And I think I realized at that time in my life that my faith needed to be more of a daily relationship, one more of trust than on following rules and maintaining control.
So that was something you suffered from, just the idea that you wanted to be a good Lutheran boy that followed all the rules and did everything right.
That's right. I'm the eldest child
and
the eldest grandchild of
My
dad is one of five kids, and I'm the eldest.
You're the prize kid.
Growing up, my mom always told me that you're special. She had a hard time getting pregnant, and so I was always, you know, my name's Matthew. She named me Gift from God. I'm the special one. And while I am grateful for the love and affection from my parents, I think I also grew up with a sense that I needed to be special. You know, I needed to be in control. I needed to act like the eldest child, the eldest grandchild. Particularly when my anxiety came when I started to move into leadership roles in my company, responsible for other people, and also was getting married at that time. I think that increased responsibility was just too much weight for me to bear.
I mean, those are growing pains, aren't they, on some level?
Yeah, I think they really are. And that's really become a defining concept in my adult life, is this idea of constant growth, continuously trying to grow. And a lot of that growing for me, I'm a big Pete Scazzaro fan. I don't know if you're familiar with
Love
Pete Scazzaro, Emotionally Healthy and Spirituality. And I follow his podcast regularly and have read.
We had him on the show.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's been on several times.
Has he?
Yeah.
He's helped me so much to think through concepts around differentiation and finding those areas in life where we might have enmeshment, whether it be with our family of origin, enmeshment with other relationships that we have, enmeshment with our job, enmeshment with our self-image, where we have a hard time sort of detaching ourselves from that. And so those concepts around differentiation, being separate but connected, have really been helpful in my faith walk.
I appreciate you sharing that part of your life with us. Let's talk a little bit about servant leadership. You recently wrote a post on five ways humble leaders put others in the spotlight. That caught my eye as well. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
I had a challenge from my spiritual director to, beginning last December, spend a significant amount of time in solitude every day focused on a word. And the word that I picked was meek.
Meek.
Yeah.
You don't hear that word very often.
You don't. I mean, it's often associated, I think, today with weak.
Yes.
And if we go back and look at the etymology of that word, the origin is that the Greeks trained their horses, their war horses, to be meek in the sense that they were strong and powerful, yet they submitted to their circumstances, to their limitations, to others. And I found that to really resonate. Of course, Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. And that really connected with me, and I've started to think about how this comes out in leadership. Patrick Lencioni has his most recent book, The Ideal Team Player, talks about hungry, humble, and humble being one of them.
Sure.
I'm drawing a blank on the other one right now. Others have talked about servant leadership. So this got me intrigued. I've been interviewing leaders and trying to identify what are the key characteristics of humble leadership with the premise that what the world needs are more humble leaders.
Isn't that the truth? We do need more humble leaders. But are leaders accepting this role and putting on this mantle, or are they saying, no, I'm in charge and I've got an iron fist and I'm going to use it?
Yeah, you know, from a faith standpoint, so much of what we read in scriptures is that we should look to the interests of others, that we should, as Tim Keller says, humility is not thinking less of ourselves, but rather thinking about ourselves less.
Right.
And so it's not so much that we're demeaning ourselves, rather that we're putting ourselves to the back of the line. I also significantly listened to Andy Stanley in his leadership podcast, and so much of what Andy Stanley talks about in leadership and in relationships and marriage. He recently did a phenomenal marriage series where he talks about the key to marriage is going to the back of the line, you know, putting your significant other first, and that, I think, applies in so many of our relationships.
Yeah, and you're married with three kids, so you get to practice that every day.
Always working on it.
How are you doing in that department?
Oh, gosh, it's so hard. I mean, it's not hard theoretically because my wife is the most important person in my life, and I admire her and am grateful for her and for our kids. I just love them. Every day I'm confronted with conflicts between their desires, their needs, and my own, whether it's my own ideal self-image or my desires and expectations, and just having to continuously submit and sacrifice those.
Yeah, how often do expectations and reality match up too? You know, that's another struggle that we all have.
Yeah, it is, both on just very surface ways, like our schedule.
Yeah.
You know, like how much sleep I want to get, when do I want to go to bed, to deeper ways in terms of how we ideally see ourselves. You know, who is this person that I think I am? And then when we're living with people, realizing that they hold a mirror up to us and reveal that we're often not the person that we want to be or think we should be.
So if I can get back to leadership and humble leadership, I just found some of these points very interesting. One was give everyone the opportunity to lead. That's a great way to empower your team, isn't it?
Yeah, you bet. You know, a lot of what the Carnegie Organization researches is employee engagement in organizations. What we find is when people feel valued and empowered, they tend to be more confident and therefore apply more discretionary effort to their work and perform at higher levels. So, yeah, so much I think of leadership and relationship is about inspiring and empowering others.
Yeah. And then also it's important to make sure that you acknowledge that the whole person shows up, you know, that you can make sure that you're encouraging a person to bring all of their talents and skills to the table and be willing to use them all.
Yeah, I think it's all of our talents and skills. So really finding out what are someone's interests and strengths and also their whole person, just like you're doing in this interview, you know, asking me questions about my whole person. I think all of us have a whole person that we bring to work, whether we reveal that or not. I think it shows up.
You spend a lot of time with people you work with, you know, and if you don't have a piece of your life open and transparent and you're just a work bot, that's no fun.
It's not. Yeah, it's more fun when we can bring our whole selves to work, get to know and really connect with other people beyond just, you know, hey, how's it going? How's your weekend? Good, fine, you know, and moving on.
Right.
But rather really getting to know others, who they are.
Yeah. I'm speaking to Matt Norman. He's the president of Norman & Associates, which offers Dale Carnegie training in North Central U.S. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. My guest in studio is Matt Norman. He's the president of Norman & Associates, which offers Dale Carnegie training in the North Central U.S. And everybody knows Dale Carnegie is a global organization. And I just realized that something that stuck in my head from many, many, many decades ago was something that Dale Carnegie said. What are some other things that Dale has said that is probably lodged in my brain? What are some of your favorite Dale Carnegie-isms?
Yeah, certainly talk in terms of other people's interests is one that really resonates. Don't criticize, condemn, or complain.
Ooh. All right. Don't criticize, condemn, or complain. Yeah, that should be standard operating procedure, shouldn't it?
It's difficult, isn't it?
It is. Don't we have that little critical spirit in our head that pays rent in that little studio apartment?
We do.
Hey, you remember me?
Yeah, it's the accuser. It's that voice in our heads, whether it's criticizing ourselves, condemning ourselves, or doing it to others in ways that may be proud or just generally, you know, critical. And his second principle in his book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, is show honest and sincere appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
I think those key words being honest and sincere. Mm-hmm. You know, when we really seek to appreciate others and look for what's good in others, that it strengthens our relationship with them and also, I think, improves our own posture towards them.
Yeah. I think it was Billy Graham that said, imitating Christ is opening the door to friendship. So there's a certain level of connection I think we're talking about as well, aren't we?
I think that's right. You know, so much of what Jesus talked about was, you know, unity in the kingdom, in the body, harmony with our brothers and sisters. And that requires intentionality in how we do relationships.
Yeah.
You know, I think our default posture, you know, we operate from our limbic brain, our lizard brain.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
The part of our brain that just says, I want, or that complains when we're uncomfortable or scared and fights for survival. And so we have to intentionally work against that part of our brain and be intentional in our relationships so that we can ultimately reach higher levels of connection with others and with God.
All right. This is fun. So a couple others?
Well, let's see. I certainly appreciate his commentary about confidence and taking risks.
Say more about that.
Well, he often talks about, you know, Carnegie started his career teaching public speaking at the YMCA in New York City and realized that the best way for people to improve their public speaking was just to get them up on their feet and start giving talks, and he would coach them in the moment. And he realized that because public speaking is one of the biggest fears that people have, getting them up on their feet increased their confidence in that area of public speaking, which then could transfer to other scary parts of their lives.
Mm.
So public speaking has continued to be a significant part of all the work that we do. It may not be like giving a presentation per se, but it just getting up on our feet, doing something that stretches our comfort zone so that we stretch our confidence. And Carnegie believed that confidence was key to us showing up well in relationships. If we're showing up in relationships with fear or scarcity, then we tend to want to be more critical, less appreciation. Whereas when we show up with more of an abundance mindset, then we tend to be more positive.
Yeah. Matt, talk about self-talk, because obviously in your business, you can't have a lot of space or time for that if it's negative. You got to stay positive.
Yeah.
Obviously. I mean, you're a very entrepreneurial guy. So when you get up every day, you got to go make it happen.
That's right. Yeah, you know, it's certainly in our business, we want to model the principles that we advocate. At the same time, we're human, you know.
Right.
And the subtext of my blog is leading as a human being, not a human doing.
Right.
And part of that's to be vulnerable and admit who we really are and admit the challenges and those dark tapes that can sometimes play and get us down. And having said that, this job does really challenge me to continuously listen to those tapes, be aware of those tapes, and replace those tapes with truth.
Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things I hear more and more from people who are feeling beat up in life. They're quick to, condemn a mistake they made. They're quick to beat themselves up and say, you know, I'm so stupid, or what was I thinking? And making a mistake doesn't make you a bad person. It just means you made a mistake.
That's right.
And, you know, I think the Chinese have an expression, you know, fall down 7 times, get up 8.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when it comes to innovation and performance, we see that making mistakes is very important. One of my favorite.
It's key, isn't it?
It's so key.
Yeah.
You know, one of my favorite, when we talk about growth, one of my favorite thought leaders in this area is Anders Ericsson, who kind of coined the 10,000 hours concept.
Yeah. Yeah.
Malcolm Gladwell wrote about that. And what he talks about is that to grow, top performers in really any area need to deliberately practice their craft. It's not so much about just putting time in, but you have to deliberately practice. And deliberate practice requires us to fail. It's got to be painful. It's got to be uncomfortable. And it often requires someone outside of ourselves to see us, whether that's a therapist or a coach or a friend who can say, you know, try this differently. I know it's going to be uncomfortable, but you might approach that situation differently next time. And that means we're going to make mistakes.
Yeah, and when you are making mistakes, it's sometimes a few people know about it, and other times you're behind a microphone on Faith Radio and everybody knows about it. And so it's very humbling.
It is. Yeah, even a moment ago when I was trying to remember the elements of the book that I was referencing, the anxiety builds as I'm thinking people are listening to me right now. I think that's why speaking in public can tend to be an area like if I can do this well, if I can speak in front of 25 people or whatever the case may be, I can transfer that confidence, that success. In Carnegie, it's not about criticizing someone.
Yeah.
It's about having you sit down feeling more successful. And in today's age with social media and all the visibility that we have to our gaffes in public, it's critical that we are careful with the tapes that play.
Well, Matt, I think it's people make mistakes when they sit on their couch rehearsing in their head what they're going to say at a meeting, but they've never practiced standing up and presenting.
Yeah.
So it's not the same, is it?
It's not.
You could be practicing, and you get up and you freeze bad because your physiological situation dictates that I'm not sitting on my couch anymore.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So that's why Anders Ericsson talks about deliberate practice,
yes.
This idea that it's got to be practice that really pushes our comfort zone. And also that we will use the metaphor often in our programs of stretching a rubber band. When you stretch a rubber band and release the rubber band, it will come back to a smaller shape than when you were stretching it, but it won't conform to its original shape.
Mm-hmm.
And so often it's helpful if we stretch ourselves in situations like my son's a baseball player, and as he warms up in the on-deck circle, he often has weight around the bat so that when he steps up to the plate, he's even freer to swing the bat.
Right.
I think there's opportunities for all of us to put the metaphorical weight on the bat before we enter into a difficult situation.
Yeah. We just by nature don't like difficult or uncomfortable, but that really is the key to growth in anything you do.
It really is.
I mean, this is not rocket science, but in order to get something, you have to make some sacrifice and put yourself in a vulnerable, risky, semi-dangerous situation. That's why I think it's important to not take yourself too seriously. Laugh at yourself, folks, because if you can do that, you're going to be just fine.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mentioned Pete Scazzaro. I just listened to a podcast of his yesterday, and he was saying that to become our true selves is very painful. It's uncomfortable to continue to confront our false self and become more of our true self. That's what growth's all about, and I really think it's what we're called to do.
Matt Norman, you are a delight. Thanks for coming on to the program. If you want to go to his website, mattnorman.com, MATTNORMAN.com. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute.
It's never just a kid's book. For the Colson Center, I'm John Stone Street with The Point. Researchers recently compared popular kids' books from China and the U.S., and they found quite a discrepancy. While kids in China read stories about industrious men who dig up mountains and young children working hard to make neat letters, American youngsters generally read about happy kids finding enjoyment with their friends. In fact, Chinese storybooks promote hard work and perseverance about twice as often as U.S. books. This might explain why kids in China regularly score higher on academic tests, while U.S. kids are so obsessed with being happy. The research confirms what we are. Already know that stories shape us. A story brought King David to repentance. A parable about a good Samaritan has inspired Christians to bind wounds for two millennia. See, stories, as C.S. Lewis said, steal past the watchful dragons of skepticism to implant in our minds a picture of things worth valuing. Kids' books are more than just a story. They're tools for molding hearts and minds. I'm John Stone Street.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Do? Why, if I had a brain, I could
while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain.
and my head. I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain.
It is 32 minutes after the hour. My friend and colleague from prestigious West Des Moines, Patrick Albanese, is my guest. He recently flew on Air Force 3248, which is just a basic Delta flight to Chicago. Patrick, how are you?
You know what? I feel great.
Good.
Actually, I took a couple of days off from the gym, and I went back today, and I was moving weights today that I have not seen in years. Seriously. I mean, specifically 50, 52 years.
Well, then the pink ones or the beige ones?
The blue. No, the blue.
The baby blue. Yeah, okay. So you were working hard today.
I had to dump a little bit of the sand out. But
do they ever catch you doing that? Because I know you take a big pan and you pound on the little end of the blue baby blue dumbbell to get some of the sand out.
Just, you know, I think more sinister, and I should probably go undo my nasty work that I've done. But I go in with, you know, stickers and I grab the 25 pound dumbbells and I just put, you know, 85 on there. I just put a little sticker that says 85. And, you know, people, of course, they say those seem kind of small for 85s. They go, hey, it's a special
density.
Polymer.
It's all density.
It's a polymer.
The polymer density.
Yes.
All right. I was talking to Rebecca, and I was talking about your appearance on Password back in the 80s, I believe. You moved out to California. This kid from Chicago moves to California, tries to establish himself, figures, well, how about I go on a game show? And you auditioned to get on a game show, and not only did you get on a game show, but you were quite successful. And your story of victory is so funny to me, and I thought our listeners would love hearing about it.
It was I had lived in Florida for I left Chicago, lived in Florida for 4 years, and realized that I was actually not in California at that point in time, and that I was supposed to turn right when I got to Interstate 80, not to the east. So that took about 4 years to figure out. So anyway, when I finally made it to California, I thought, you know, I've got some cash in my pocket and this should last me a while. Well, nothing lasts very long in California. Pretty soon I needed money and I could not find a job. So somebody said, hey, why don't you try it for a game show? And I turned on the morning game shows and I said, well, I think I can do this Password one, Super Password with Bert Convy. So I found out that they do hold auditions. I went to the audition, which was surprisingly difficult because you think, well, how hard can this be? But, they want you to be pretty bubbly because when the cameras go on, it's a bit nerve-wracking. And then I sat through – they would tape 5 shows in a day.
Wow.
So they took a week's worth of shows. So Bert Convy would show up for work approximately 5-6 days a month. I think Pat Sajak on a similar schedule. And tape 5 or 6 weeks worth of shows so that they can get the summer off because that 5 to 6 days a month of work really takes it out of you.
It does.
You need the summer.
You got to learn how to pace yourself.
Yeah. Anyway, I had it. You don't know when you're going to get called, so I sat through watching multiple shows, and I finally get called, and I'm brought in, and I'm with a couple of celebrity contestants, and I proceed to get beaten pretty badly by the other contestant. And the thing is that it was the middle of a taping day. So we got to the end of the taping day. We hadn't quite finished. She didn't quite finish me off. I was hanging by a thread, and they said, that's the end of the taping day. We'll come back in a couple days, go home for the weekend. We're going to tape again on Monday. This was a Friday. So go home, come back, and finish losing. So I went home, and it was a Friday, and I didn't sleep very well because I thought, gosh, I went through all this effort, and here I am, and I'm getting knocked out swiftly. So I get up in the morning, and another uncustomary thing for me, I didn't watch much TV back then, but I turn on the TV, and there's a little claymation thing on, and I go, oh, I like claymation. That's fun, entertaining sort of stop motion animation things. It was pretty special back in 87. And so I watch it, and they did a thing on the Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, a Mark Twain story, which I had never read, had no idea about, but it was so darn claymation-y and entertaining that I thoroughly enjoyed it and said, well, that was fun. That was a nice distraction from my troubles. Anyway, Monday rolls around and I put on another suit and I show up for the set of Super Password. And the way that the game used to work is you would have to guess a series of words, and then those five words, when you got all five of them on there, you had to guess what the theme of the puzzle was, what it was. And so this game starts, and I go, well, I'm just about to be finished off, and the first word goes up, and the celebrity contestant says, leaping, and I say, jumping, and she says, yeah, so I win, and I get the first word. And the next word is, she gives me the clue, she goes, toad. I say, frog. And they're like, yes, hey, pretty good, jumping frog. And I'm thinking, oh, that's interesting. And then the third word was Mississippi, which I got. And Calaveras County is in Mississippi. And so we've got jumping frog Mississippi up on the board. And I say, hey, can I just take a stab at solving the puzzle? Because I figure I'm going to lose anyway. And they go, yeah. I go, is it a jumping frog of Calaveras County, Mark Twain? And they're like, yes, you're a genius. So I end up – that was the turning point. I end up winning and going on to win $17,000, which in 1987 was a lot of money for a broke kid who didn't have a job. It just was – I said, it's amazing. I just happened to turn on the TV. I happened to see this thing. I go, evidently the guy who writes the puzzles was all out of ideas and said he couldn't sleep the night before. So he's watching cartoons. I go, at least we got that in common. And it was one of those things I look back on, you know, years later, and I say, you know, was that God messing with me? Was that God intervening in my life? Was that just – it was so many coincidences, so many unique coincidences that dovetailed. And, of course, the money winnings ended up getting me into acting, of all things, believe it or not, because I was able to afford pictures and a resume, and I started doing commercial work and TV work, and then I got back into performing, and then my life went on an entirely different direction. Started doing magic again, and then, of course, I ended up down in San Diego on a fluke one day, and I saw this show called Triple Espresso that you were in. That started that chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So I always look at – sometimes I look back and I go, you know, that one little event, this little pebble on the path of my life – that you don't necessarily give it a whole lot of credence. You just say, oh, that was a, you know, kind of a little bit of a detour, the tiniest little detour. And then you trace 300 changes in your life to that one detour. It's pretty magical.
It is. Patrick, I remember in 2008, a movie came out called Slumdog Millionaire, which was a pretty captivating movie. I saw it, and this kid was able to answer all of these questions that he really had no business knowing the answers to, except he had personal experiences with each one of the answers, which made it obvious to him. And I was kind of laughing when I was thinking of your story, because you wake up discouraged on a Saturday morning, watch cartoons, something you never do, and you watch this claymation thing, which basically hands you the question or the answer to the question that's going to be happening on Monday. It's just a great story.
Yeah, and it was the turning point to so many things, and the money is gone, by the way.
Oh, I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was.
I did make it last a while, though. It was one of those moments where you say, yeah, like that movie. That's a great reference to it. Where I say, okay, that's just a coincidence on top of a coincidence, and I, you know, once again was in the right place at the right time. Golly gee, either I'm the luckiest guy alive, or maybe sometimes this stuff just is orchestrated and that's the path your life is going to take.
And God, hard to say. You know, and God is at work in your life, even when you're probably unaware of it, because he's had a great plan for your life. And now you're living his great plan, which is outstanding. But back then, you probably did not have that on your radar of maybe God intervening in your life, did you?
No, and you know, back then, I was of the mistaken and somewhat arrogant belief that, you know, God never gives you any problem that you can't handle, which, of course, first, I'm placing the blame for the problem on God, not me.
Mm-hmm.
It's his fault, not mine. He did it. He did it, Your Honor. And secondly, then I'm saying, don't worry, God, you made a mess of things in my life, but I can fix them.
Right.
Thanks to the tools you've given me. And then I realized it was actually, I had it the opposite way, that all along, you know, God's always there. He's always this presence. And no matter what you do, there's not a lifeline of some type that he can't throw you. But you have to ask. You know, he's the guy on the side of the ring. He's your tag team, you know, WWF guy that says, anytime you're ready, you got to tag me. But you have to tag.
Yeah.
You have to ask. You have to tag. And then you got to let him come in and do his thing. And it's not going to necessarily go the way you want. But I go, oh, gosh, I had that all backwards. But I had a lot of things backwards back then.
Yeah. Well, you have admitted to that. And I find it that you can learn a lot from just hearing people's past experiences, because you wandered into New Age. And you were not only very inquisitive, but you read the books and you talked to the teachers in New Age. And really what you came up with was like nothing.
Well, I said there's some things here that just don't make any sense. And, there was a certain sense of feeling like, look at me. I'm so above that Christianity stuff. Why those guys? What do they know? I'm so enlightened. I'm so edumacated. I've got it all together, because everything makes perfect sense. And then you get to some of those unusual areas of New Age where they say, by the way, the 6 million people that Hitler killed, they had arranged in a previous lifetime for that to happen. I said, I'm struggling with that one there. there would be things like that would pop up in New Age. And because one of the things New Age delivered was that there is no bad, there is no evil. And if you just think the right thoughts, you will never experience a day of grief, misery, dissatisfaction, disappointment. It will all go perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not possible.
Nah, it's not at all. All right. As you talk about being an actor and being in Hollywood and living many years in Los Angeles, it is interesting what has come about with movies like Mission Impossible 6, which is coming out. And when we come back from the break, I want to ask you about that and another movie that came out in 1985 and how things have changed in the business over the last, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Be back with Patrick Albanese in just a minute. My guest on the studio line is Patrick Albanese, not only a friend, but a colleague from prestigious West Des Moines.
And what does that mean?
What does that mean?
Colleague. It means we work together.
Yeah, we work together. We kind of do this. We're in the same business, kind of, so to speak.
We do colleaguing.
We're colleaguing together.
Colleaguing, yes.
Yeah, colleaguing. All right. I wanted to, you did a great job of drawing this comparison about Mission Impossible 6 is coming out now. And I got to say, whether you're a Tom Cruise fan or not, this guy puts on some crazy movies. I mean, he is a fearless actor, and he does all of his own stunts. It's pretty nuts. And he's 56 years old.
Yeah. We watched Mission Impossible 1 the other day, which, that one was a decent number of years ago. But I was looking at the stunts that he was doing back then, and he's on top. He's jumping on helicopters, jumping on trains. He's on top of a speeding train. I say, that's not a green screen there.
They're
really up there. And this thing's going fast. Although, John Voight was up there kind of, doing his thing. I don't think he could do that now. But the guy's amazing. He is amazing, and I do like his movies. But I was laughing because I saw this comparison. I said, oh, God, how old is he now for Mission Impossible
6?
He's 56 years old. So do you remember the movie Cocoon?
Yes, 1985.
1985. So that's a little over 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about a bunch of old guys and
old
gals.
People. Yeah.
Old people.
Yes.
Old people. And then these alien pods were in the neighbor's swimming pool. And that has happened to me.
Yeah, I'm sure it has.
But I would not get in the pool with it. And when they swim in it, they've discovered sort of this fountain of youth. But it can kind of be bad for the aliens. These things always have a downside. But one of the old people in the movie was played by Wilford Brimley, who mm-hmm. most of us would say, yeah, he's pretty old. But at the time of the filming of Cocoon, playing the old man, he was 51 years old, 5 years younger than Tom Cruise is right now.
Yeah.
In fact, in 1985, Risky Business comes out when Tom Cruise is, in his early 20s, mid-20s.
Yeah.
And he played a teenager pretty much. He played like an 18-year-old kid,
mm-hmm.
where his parents are gone and he's having a little bit of fun taking care of the house. He runs into some problems. So either Tom Cruise has discovered the fountain of youth and he actually has alien pods in his swimming pool. That's just a theory, mind you.
Yeah.
Or some of his weird, I don't know. I think there was, you always read those stories in the tabloids anyway. The weird, when his daughter was born, they did all sorts of strange things, and you go, maybe that works. Maybe it works. I don't know.
Well, I did watch I haven't been to a movie in years. I'm going to go see this one, but I watched the trailer, and after 2.5 minutes, I was practically out of breath. You just cannot believe the stuff that he puts himself in harm's way. The stunt crews basically say, there's no insurance company that would take us on, because he's just risking his life every day on the set. Anyway,
I remember that from one of his other movies where he did the stunts, and I thought, well, no insurance company would let him do that. And then you find out, yep, that's right, they didn't. I think he had to insure the movie himself.
Which he probably did. It's his production company. All right, let's chat about some of the news items that happened over the weekend. I was busy working, so I didn't know that there was they released the warrant on Carter Page. What do you know about that?
Well, so it looks like they've relied pretty heavily on the dossier. It's really kind of clever what they did. The FBI testified under oath that the information to the court that the information was verified. Now we're finding out that what they mean by verified is that we spell checked it. And that, yes, Your Honor, it does say those things that we said that it said. But the dossier, which was commissioned by Fusion GPS, which was paid by this Perkins Coie law firm, which got money from Hillary Clinton. So follow that money trail. So the Christopher Steele, British agent, then hires people in Russia who then get secondhand information from other people that say, yeah, we heard these stories. We can't verify them. They report back to the people in Russia, who report back to the British agent, who then reports back to Fusion GPS, and then this dossier gets put together, and they get the okay. It's kind of like the REO Speedwagon system of gathering information. It's heard it from a friend who heard it from a friend who heard it from another. You were in a hotel with some hired help.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't verify it, and so now they kind of released it over the weekend, which is usually a good sign they want something to sort of disappear. And they kept saying every time they reapplied for this that, well, this Carter Page, right, we know for a fact he's working with Russian agents, and Russia has recruited him to be a spy. I'm thinking, why is this guy walking around free, going on all the talk shows then? I mean, you're smearing this guy saying, you're a spy, and we know it, and we have proof. You're going, what's wrong with our law enforcement? That does not instill a lot of, what would you call that, faith in our law enforcement agencies, that they're saying, yeah, this guy here, he's a spy. Uh-huh. And he's working for the Russians. And he was on NBC last night. Okay. Having trouble locating him? Because I know where the NBC studios are, if you guys are having any trouble.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, so I guess today Trump tweeted out that, it's time to end this whole witch hunt, because all the warrants for the wiretapping, which, remember, a year ago they said we were all crazy. Trump was crazy for saying he was wiretapped. But I was like, well, of course he was wiretapped, because this guy that's on TV all the time is a spy. And he's maybe going to pull they still have all these people that used to work for Obama still have like top level security clearances, which I think is funny. It's like getting fired from the bank, but they let you keep the combination to the vault. You know,
I like it. What did you think about Trump tweeting out last night at about 11:10 that to the Iranian president, don't mess with us?
He went full Cher. Cher always tweets in capital letters, and he went all caps practically. I don't know. We don't hear anything in the news about Iran, but evidently there have been protests that have been going on nonstop for months now. And recently, I guess, China has made an arrangement to get some of their energy needs elsewhere, instead of getting them from Iran. And that has, I guess, their money has bottomed out. And so they're desperate. And I guess the leader is saying, some of these sanctions that Trump has put back in place after that disastrous Iran deal have taken effect. And now people are, you know, Trump's been asking other countries stop doing business with them, quit doing business with them because they're a rogue regime and they're developing nuclear weapons. We have to stop this. And I guess it's having an effect. So I don't know if that's a, you know, I don't think this guy really wants to pull the trigger in the United States. His tweet was rather, let's just say, non-vague.
Yeah, it was non-vague yeah. For sure.
He said, we will unleash on you something the likes of the world has never seen. It's like, well, that's clear.
And then, you know, the Iranian president says that you either if you do business with us, it's going to be the mother of all peace or the mother of all wars. And I never know what that means. You know, all I know is I had the mother of all mothers.
Oh, I love it. That it's not the negotiating tactic I normally use with things. Hey, do business with me or I'll destroy you and everyone you know.
Right, right. It's just crazy. Yeah. So we've only got a couple minutes left. Your daughter took you to school on some Latin recently. Tell us that story.
Oh, my gosh. So you learn a lot from your kids. And my daughter's 9 and you know, I guess it's appropriate. It's the Supreme Court nomination process. There's this stare decisis that they always seem to be interested in, and I didn't know anything about it. And my daughter educated me on it. She lost a tooth. I go in. I don't know what the going rate for a tooth is these days, but we accidentally set it at $5. Well, I go into her room and I accidentally put a $50 bill under there, which of course you say to me, how did you get $50 in your wallet?
I know. I was about to say, what happened?
I know what you get paid.
Yeah.
Anyway, she wakes up. She says, Dad, the tooth fairy has given me $50. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, oh my, I have to undo this mistake that I have made. I go, you know, that was probably a mistake on the tooth fairy's part. It was dark in your room. And she says to me, not my problem. She says, you know something? If the tooth fairy can't make her way around in the dark, she's probably not cut out for this line of work. So I go, well, I got to cut her a little bit of slack. Might have been a little bit of a mistake. She says to me, nope, it's really a matter of stare decisis. I go, okay. What is that? She goes, it's a set precedent. You can't undo it. Every tooth from now on, $50. Next day, she's in the garage, and I see her with a hammer. She's about to pound on a tooth, and I'm thinking, what are you doing? She says, well, I saw something cool at the store. I figure it cost me 2 to 3 teeth. I'm like, when you're done with that, loan that hammer to Daddy. He's going he's got a couple things he wants to buy, too. Oh,
yeah.
Goodness.
And the kids went to vacation Bible school this morning, didn't they?
Yep. Starts for the week.
How many kids were at that?
1,500, 1,800. Wow. It was a sea of children.
Wow. That's really encouraging. And, you know, it's now cool to go to VBS, isn't it?
Yeah. We didn't have that. We had – our parents went on vacation. They said, read the Bible. We'll be back in a week. That was vacation Bible school.
It's really true. It's really true. But we didn't have structured activities when we were growing up. You left the house in the morning, and your mom would say, be back by dinner, and that was it.
Yeah.
You'd get a peanut butter sandwich at a friend's house for lunch, and then you'd show up at dinner time.
Right. And if they did go on vacation, grandma would come over for about a week, and that's what that's when the bloom would come off the rose on that one. We'd say, it used to be so cool going to grandma's house. I got the butterscotch candies, anything I wanted to eat. And suddenly, when she's in this household, overseeing all the activities, she's just like mom.
It's too funny. Patrick, thank you so much for coming on the show. I always look forward to our talk, and have a great rest of the night.
You too. Thanks.
Patrick Albanese has been my guest from prestigious West Des Moines. If you missed any of today's show and you want to hear it, you can go to myfaithradio.com, check out the webpage, and you can send these episodes on, these podcasts on to friends or family, and you can listen to it again if you missed some of it. That wraps up our show for the day. Have a great evening, everyone. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.